Welcome to 502 Conversations. I'm Brian Kirby, and my guest today is Dr. Paul Offit. And I think I'm going to rename this episode of 502 Conversations to Dumbing It Down for Brian. And you will find out why as we go into this. Dr. Offit, how are you doing today?
I'm hanging in there. Thanks for asking, Brian.
Oh, you're welcome. It's not just a polite question. I am interested, believe it or not. I do have a bio on you, a brief bio, so let me read that, and then we will get started. In case you don't know who Dr. Offit is, even though he's been on CNN, CNBC, PBS, The NewsHour, Dr. Oz even recently, or maybe it was a year ago, Dr. Offit is a pediatrician and a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is an expert on vaccines, immunology, and virology. Dr. Offit is co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine Rototech, which is credited with saving lives every day. You are a member of VRBPAC, the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Committee. You have published hundreds of papers in medical and scientific journals, and you are the author of 12 books, including Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and your most recent book, You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. All right, let's get right at it. COVID numbers, I have other things to talk about, of course, but I do have some questions about COVID. I looked this up a couple of days ago, so correct me if I'm wrong. We're at 400 daily deaths, some 2,300 last week, over 15,000 total in August. It's affecting the U.S. average life expectancy. I think now it's like the third leading cause of death in the U.S. Most deaths still in the unvaccinated, but approximately 30% of the U.S. population is unvaccinated. Approximately 30% of the population in the United States is unvaccinated. I have three questions about this. Is this our steady state? Does it need to be? And with vaccination rates, how do you, as a virologist, factor in people that have been infected and recovered?
Right. So 2 years ago, when this virus came into this country, in January, February of 2020, we didn't have vaccines, we didn't have antivirals, we didn't have monoclonals. We were a blank slate. No one in this country or in this world, when this virus came out, had immunity to this virus. And so it was devastating. The only thing we could do at that time was to mask, social distance, isolate, quarantine, test, restrict travel, close down businesses, close down schools. So we are much better off than we were then, just so we're clear. I mean, you now have not 0% population immunity. You probably have 95% population immunity from people who've been vaccinated or naturally infected or both, and you have vaccines and you have antivirals. So instead of going through 3,000 deaths a day, 3,500 deaths a day, 4,000 deaths a day, which was where we were, like in that at the end of that first winter when the virus, you know, had come in, we are at, you know, a few hundred deaths. And it's important also to know who's dying. I think we need to, because we don't have a national healthcare system, we need to really define who's dying with this virus and who's dying from it. I know in our hospital, you know, we probably about 3%, everybody who comes into our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, who is admitted to the hospital will be tested to see whether they have COVID, independent of whether or not that's why they're being admitted. So right now, the it's probably about 3% or so of kids are positive. Most of those kids aren't admitted because they have COVID, but they count as that. And I do think you need to be careful about that. So I think your question, which is a great one, is this a steady state? I mean, you know, you have President Biden recently saying, you know, the pandemic's over. But to his credit, the following statement, he said, we are still going to be dealing with this virus. And that's true. I think what probably reasonably said is we're moving from a pandemic phase to an endemic phase where we're going to be living with this virus now, not only for years, but probably decades. And so how do we move forward with this? Because if you define pandemic in a functional way, meaning that it changes the way you live, work, or play, you would argue in many areas of this country, we are past the pandemic because most people act as if there's nothing going on. I mean, you look at that Eagles game the other day, which I'd like to point out, the Eagles beat Minnesota 24-7. But you look at that Eagles game, you know, you had, I didn't see anybody wearing a mask of the 67,000 people that had gathered there all close together. People weren't wearing masks. As far as they're concerned, there is no pandemic. So, but there is. I mean, there certainly is still a virus that's circulating that's going to continue to circulate. You look interesting, there's four strains of human coronavirus that circulate. The first two were identified in the early 1960s. Both came from bats, human coronaviruses that came from bats like this one. The first one probably entered the human population in the late 1700s, the other one in the late 1800s. We're going to be dealing with this virus for a while. And the question is, how do we do that? How do we protect the vulnerable people moving forward? I mean, people who have no immunity, or who people who, even if they have been vaccinated, could still be, you know, hospitalized and killed by this virus. How do we protect them?
So is this the steady state?
I think the thing about this virus is you should never make predictions, because you're always going to be wrong. I think we will get to this point where the virus, well, let me take a step back. It's a short incubation period, respiratory mucosal infection. For short incubation periods like this, you are never going to prevent mild disease, not over the long term, because mild disease is prevented by neutralizing antibodies, which are short-lived. Even if this virus never mutated, even if this, if 100% of the population were vaccinated, the virus would still spread. And I guess my reason to say that is I was fortunate enough to be part of a team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that created the rotavirus vaccine, another short incubation period, mucosal, in this case, intestinal infection. That virus was very common in the childhood population, circulated, caused 75,000 babies every year to be hospitalized with severe dehydration, and about 60 to die every year. The vaccine's been out since 2006, so it's been out for 16 years. You probably have 90 to 95% uptake in the childhood population with that vaccine. We have eliminated virtually hospitalization. So most residents, pediatric residents, have never seen a case of rotavirus-induced dehydration, but it still circulates in the community and it still causes mild disease. So that's it. When do you get to the point where you just have that? Knowing that mild disease is not going to be mild for some. For example, people who have chronic lung disease or heart disease or type 1 diabetes that's out of control, a mild illness for them could cause them to go to the hospital or die. People who are immune compromised, despite vaccination, may still, you know, be hospitalized or killed by this virus. And obviously the elderly, by the elderly, since I'm getting older, I've redefined elderly to be people over 75. Because that's really, if you look at the CDC data, that's really who is getting hospitalized and killed by this virus, despite vaccination, because they don't make very good immune responses is the problem, especially long-lived T-cell responses. So that's what you're going to be dealing with going forward. So is this the steady state? We may be getting close to the steady state. We'll see, because you probably have 95% population immunity right now. I'm not sure you're going to do much better than that.
One thing I overlooked in my question there, I don't have any information on pediatric vaccination status of COVID-19. And let's talk maybe under 12.
It's poor. If you have to answer the question, what group in this country is the least vaccinated, it's people less than 18 years of age. For people 12 to 15 years old, probably about 60 to 65% have been vaccinated. For people 5 to 11 year old, about 35 to 40%. And for people less than 5 years of age, fewer than 10% have been vaccinated. Now they're all going back to school. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I worry about that. I worry that what you're going to see as the children go back to school, many of whom are unvaccinated, that you're going to see the kinds of diseases that children get with this virus, like croup, bronchiolitis, and that for that reason they'll be hospitalized. And remember, the young child is at risk of dying. The less than five-year-old is at risk of dying from this virus. I mean, it's 1,000-fold less than, say, someone over 75, but you still have a risk of dying. So I really am distraught that parents have chosen not to vaccinate their children and sent them to school.
And let's be clear, it's safe and it's effective in all age populations.
Yes, I mean, you have a lot of data at this point.
All right, now let's get to the dumbing it down for me part, because here's something I'm completely confused about. It's a bit of a setup for a question, and you can take this any way you want and answer it any way you want, because I am confused. This bivalent booster, both Moderna and Pfizer, the bivalent was authorized back on August 31st. I think you voted against it. The monovalent vaccine no longer authorized as a booster. Okay. So the bivalent is a reduced original ancestral strain plus some kind of Omicron strain. Is it more effective than the ancestral vaccine? Is it the original shot still doing most of the heavy lifting? I have some other questions, but what about that portion of it?
Right. Let me start with the good news. Okay. And I'm going to start from the beginning.
Okay.
Which is a very good place to start. When the virus raised its head in Wuhan, that virus that killed hundreds of people and ultimately thousands of people in the area in and around Wuhan, that strain was isolated in January of 2020 and sequenced. It was called the Wuhan 1 strain. That is the vaccine, the virus to which all vaccines are made. The you got a vaccine to protect against the Wuhan 1 strain. Now, that's not the virus that left China. The virus that left China was a strain called, it didn't have a Greek letter designation, it was called D614G. That swept across Asia, Europe, the United States, killed hundreds of thousands of people. It was replaced by the Alpha strain. It was replaced by the Delta strain. So in the, if you look at the first year of the vaccine, so vaccine, right, authorized in December 2020, if you look at December 2021 and try and answer the question, did two doses of vaccine protect you against those variants? The answer was yes. Very, and it was, this is the CDC study by Mark Tenford. It was published in Clinical Infectious Diseases. You still had a high level of protection against serious disease with two doses of a vaccine that was designed to protect you against Wuhan 1, but nonetheless protected you against D614G, Alpha and Delta. Okay, so two doses, it worked. Then Omicron hit, and Omicron was a surprise. I mean, it was an immune evasive strain. It was immune evasive because you had like 30 mutations that affected that spike protein, and 15 were just in the receptor binding domain, meaning the business end of that molecule. So now all these neutralizing antibodies that you've made, you know, from getting the vaccine didn't really work to protect against that virus. So even if you've been vaccinated or you've been naturally infected or both, you could still get a mild infection and you could get it again. I mean, that's what you learn from that virus. And so what the CDC then did, we're starting now January 2022 up to the present. The CDC did studies trying to answer the question, okay, do you benefit from a third dose or do you benefit from a fourth dose? And what they found that in both cases, yes. And by benefit, I get back to the original premise here. The goal is to prevent severe illness. So by benefit, I mean protected against hospitalization. Did a third dose protect you against hospitalization? Yes. Did a fourth dose protect you against hospitalization? To a lesser extent, yes. But the critical question there is who was being protected? Who benefited from that third dose? Who benefited from the fourth dose? Was it everybody? And the answer was no, it wasn't everybody. It was basically three groups. One, the elderly, people over 75, people who lived in nursing homes. Two is people who had serious medical conditions, meaning, you know, chronic lung disease, chronic heart disease, liver disease, kidney disease, out of control type 1 diabetes. And the reason is they couldn't handle a mild infection. Even if they got a mild infection, that could land them in the hospital because they were so compromised. And then third were immunocompromised folks. So I think that when you launch this current campaign for the booster dose, and I'll get to bivalent in a second, when you launch this current campaign, I really think it would make more sense to target those populations at highest risk and not try and vaccinate everybody. In terms of the bivalent vaccine, that came up to our committee on June 28th of this year, and we were asked to consider that. The data that were presented to us were not the data on this vaccine, because this vaccine hadn't been made yet, meaning this bivalent vaccine made by Pfizer and Moderna has, as you know, as the name bivalent suggests, has two different vaccines in it. One is the ancestral strain, the original Wuhan 1 strain, and two is an Omicron subvariant, BA4, BA5. BA4, BA5 are very similar, so that's why they're always linked together. So it's not three vaccines, it's two vaccines, and the second one is BA4, BA5. Now you could argue, doesn't it make sense, since BA4, BA5 are essentially all the strains that are circulating right now, why give the Wuhan 1 strain as a vaccine? Why not give the BA4, BA5? Won't that be better? And that certainly on its surface makes sense. But there really are no data right now to support the fact that it is better. And there are reasons why. If you looked at the data that were presented to us, they didn't use BA4, BA5, used BA1. The original Omicron, thinking that that will then predict what we'll see with BA4, BA5. And so they did the studies the right way. Both companies did the studies the right way. They took people who got three doses of the ancestral strain and gave them either a fourth dose of the ancestral strain or a fourth dose of the bivalent vaccine containing BA1, and then looked to see if you got that bivalent vaccine, did you clearly have a higher level of neutralizing antibodies against BA1? And the answer was, depending on which company, it was about 1.5-fold higher or 1.75-fold higher. That is not likely to be a clinically significant difference. I mean, if you go back in time to December 2020, Moderna's vaccine had about a 2-fold greater difference in neutralizing antibodies than Pfizer's vaccine, but that did not translate to better protection against serious illness. It didn't. So why would we think this would be true? The other thing is that when you combine them in the same vial, when you give the shot of two vaccines at once, It's taken up by the local lymph node, right? Well, that local lymph node is already primed for a response to Wuhan 1. So when it then travels to that local lymph node, all those B cells, which are the kind of cells that make antibodies, are all there ready to respond to Wuhan 1, not to the new strain. So it sort of dampens it out. It dilutes that effect, so-called original antigenic sin or imprinting. You're imprinted to that original strain. So that hurts you. The other thing is that the decision that was made by both companies was, and let's look at Moderna, for example. If you get a booster dose of Moderna's vaccine before the bivalent vaccine was available, you get 50 micrograms. You, as an adult, Brian, would get 50 micrograms. But when you get the bivalent vaccine, you don't get 50 and 50. You get 25 and 25. And the thinking was, well, 25 plus 25 equals 50. Which from an arithmetic standpoint is absolutely correct. But from a biological standpoint, it's not. Because what you're doing is you're giving two vaccines at a child's booster dose. And I think that's probably in part why you didn't see a dramatic increase. The other thing is, and this is a paper that just was published online by the New England Journal of Medicine within the past 2 days and should be in the print edition this week. Moderna published a study and they had clinical data. There were clinical data. And what they found was in those two groups, where either one group got the bivalent vaccine or the other group just got the ancestral strain, they had 16 cases of SARS-CoV-2 infections. 11 were in the bivalent group and 5 were in the monovalent group. They had 6 cases of clinically significant illness. 5 were in the bivalent group. 1 was in the monovalent group. Now, those numbers are small, probably not statistically significant. That may not play out in the long run. But again, it doesn't support the notion that the bivalent vaccine is dramatically better, or likely to be dramatically better than the monovalent vaccine. I don't think it will be worse. I don't think it will be less safe. But what worries me is that it's being sold that way. It's being sold in a different way. It's being sold as it's going to be great. This is going to protect against mild disease. This is going to prevent transmission. This is going to be much better because it contains the current strains, where none of the evidence to date supports that. And I just, now it may. It may eventually support that, and hopefully we'll do the kind of studies that answers that question. But don't promise something that doesn't, at least on its surface right now, appear to be true, because all you're going to do is just potentially further erode trust in public health agencies. And I feel like it's being oversold. Now, that said, 21 people voted on June 28th. 19 voted yes. I was one of only 2 that voted no. So I'm a minority opinion, but my minority opinion is based on evidence.
And let's make it clear, though, it's kind of you weren't voting against it because it wasn't safe.
That's right. I wasn't voting against it because I think we didn't need it. I mean, here's the good news. If there's any good news about SARS-CoV-2, here it is. The goal is to protect against severe disease. That's really not mediated by neutralizing antibodies. That's primarily mediated by T cells, so-called cytotoxic T cells, which are the kind of cells that kill virus-infected cells. They're generally long-lived. Memory cytotoxic T cells are generally long-lived. And it takes a while to develop serious illness. So although it takes a while also for memory cytotoxic T cells to become activated, differentiate, and kill virus-infected cells, there's plenty of time to protect you against severe disease. So that's good. The other thing is that if you look at Wuhan 1, the original strain, and compare it to BA4, BA5, this Omicron subvariant, they aren't that different in terms of the regions recognized by T cells. Those are generally well conserved. Really 80% conservation for these different types of T cells. That's why you're still protected against severe disease. That's why when you see Omicron hit or the subvariants hits and you see this dramatic increase in cases, you don't see a dramatic increase in severe cases because you're still protected against the severe disease, even though you aren't as protected against mild disease.
I was thinking perhaps this would become a yearly shot. You mentioned New England Journal of Medicine. Another part of my confusion, I think last Wednesday or Thursday, there was a letter to the editor basically calling for this might be a quarterly thing. And then in JAMA on Friday, there was also a paper that was starting to hint at that. I don't know. I don't know if you saw that, if you want to talk about it at all or just move on.
I think we're losing our way here. I fear if the goal is to prevent severe disease, the question is, what's the best strategy to do that? You could argue that someone like me, I've had 3 doses of vaccine, I had a mild infection, I probably have very good immunity. I suspect I am protected against severe disease for a while. The question is how long? And I think it's up to incumbent upon the CDC doing epidemiological studies to answer that question. Similarly, for people who got 2 doses or 3 doses or 4 doses as a healthy young person, say somebody less than 65, How long are they protected against severe disease? So I'd like to see studies from the CDC trying to answer that question a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, in concert with immunologists doing studies to look at those frequencies of memory T cells to see whether those two things comport. And they do, to date, comport. You're protected against severe disease because you have high levels of memory T cells. And that's the goal, protect against severe disease. If that's not the goal, if the goal is to try and prevent all mild illness, which is to say, try and keep neutralizing antibodies high, then you're just going to need to keep boosting and boosting and boosting, which is not a viable public health strategy. It doesn't make sense. It's not doable. People aren't going to accept it, nor should they.
Okay, great. Let's just sum that up. So if you're elderly or have some risk factors, good idea to get the boost. If you're sick, so let me run a scenario for you. You got your original two shots. Then you got a case of COVID a year ago. Where does that put you? Still in the 95%? Well, you can't speak specifically, but there are a lot of people like that that had the original two shots. Then they got COVID maybe last fall, and so they did not get a booster because that was good. So where are we now a year later?
I think you're probably still good. I think in all the evidence is you're probably, if you're a healthy person, a healthy young person less than 65, you've gotten two doses of vaccines, then you got a mild natural infection or an infection that didn't require you going to the hospital, which is, or said another way, that didn't require getting supplemental oxygen, which is sort of the definition of severe infection. I think you're probably good. The question is for how long. I think we'll learn that over time.
And that we will start to see. There will be some data on all that, I guess. But although they won't be collecting data on the ancestral strain anymore because you can't get it.
I know, that's too bad. There are countries where you still can get both, but I think it's too bad. I'd also like to offer one other thing. Anytime you give a biological agent, people have said to me, well, what's the downside, right? There's no downside. The worst comes to worst. You know, I'm not protected for that long against mild disease. There's always a downside. Whenever you inject anybody with a biological agent, you know, and that has an upside, it has to have a downside. That's always true. And if you look, for example, there was a study that was just reported out of Thailand where Pfizer did a study where they looked at children between 13 and 18 years of age. And this is why I'm a little opposed to the giving everybody over 12 years of age a booster dose. They looked at children 13 years of age, 300 children in Thailand in school between 13 and 18 years of age. And right before they gave them the second boost, they took blood. And then they looked 3 days later, 7 days later, 14 days later. And what they were looking for was evidence of heart muscle enzymes like troponin, creatine kinase. Were you making an immune response against your own heart? Now, these were people who didn't necessarily have any symptoms. They just wanted to, because they were assuming there may be an asymptomatic immune response against your own heart with a transient myocarditis. Carditis just means inflammation of the heart, and myocarditis means literally inflammation of the heart muscle. And what they found was that in 2.5%, meaning in 1 in 45 children, there was. Now, it came down again. It was transient, short-lived, self-resolving, but that's what happens. You make a short-lived immune response to your own heart. It was all males, all young males. So just know that. Do I think it's going to be a long-term problem? I don't know. I mean, we'll find out over time. But nothing's free. And I think if the benefits are clear, if you're in a group, even if you're 12 years old and you have the kind of condition that puts you at high risk of serious COVID, get a vaccine. I completely agree with that. But if you're otherwise healthy and young, I'm not sure why you necessarily need it now. You may get a mild infection, but you're not going to get a severe infection. And the goal should not be to try and prevent mild infection because it's not an attainable goal.
You just mentioned something. There are still these, I don't know if you call it memes or whatnot, circulating on AM radio and around about why you shouldn't do this. Do you mind hitting any of that misinformation real quick?
Tell me the memes you're talking about.
Well, I'm still hearing things like, we don't know what's going to happen 10 years from now if you get an mRNA shot. There's sudden death syndrome, changes in DNA. I mean, these have been gone over and over again, but they're still, you know, you turn on the radio, if you hit the right station, boom, they're coming up. Do you want to hit that at all? Or, I mean, it's been long. Go ahead.
Yeah, not surprisingly. I mean, when you introduce any vaccine into the United States, you're going to get those typical anti-vaccine tropes, you know, which is
tropes.
Vaccine, the vaccine, you know, and if causes you to make spike protein, which is toxic to your cells, or it alters, because it's a genetic vaccine, it alters your own DNA, which is not possible, actually. That the vaccine causes sudden vet death syndrome, that we don't know what's going to happen 20 years from now. I mean, that's all nonsense, just utter nonsense. I mean, there are legitimate reasons to think, you know, do the benefits of that vaccine for me, for example, pretending I'm a healthy young person as compared to a healthy old person, does it benefit? That's a reasonable question, but those are not reasonable concerns. And so, but it's not surprising. The fact of the matter is, you're much more likely to be hospitalized and die if you're not vaccinated. There's no good reason not to get vaccinated. And unfortunately, about 30% of the population isn't vaccinated.
Okay. A couple of years ago in conversation, it's been a long time. You mentioned, there's going to be heroes and villains at the end of this. I don't know if we're at that phase yet, but I saw this Lancet Commission. I don't know if you saw this. I'll put on my glasses here. It was called the Lancet Commission on Lessons for the Future from the COVID-19 Pandemic was released. Did you see this? Okay, I won't go into it then, but it was...
You can tell me about it. I'm curious.
I got to tell you, yikes. I didn't read all of it. It's 50 pages long, but they really fired a shot at the WHO. And I'll give you this quote. "This staggering death toll is both a profound tragedy and a massive global failure at multiple levels. Too many governments have failed to adhere to basic norms of institutional rationality and transparency. Too many people, often influenced by misinformation, have disrespected and protested against basic public health precautions. And the world's major powers have failed to collaborate to control the pandemic." That's how it opened. Yikes. That's a strong... And then it went through like eight other things, man. That is a strong statement.
I certainly think we can do better. I mean, and could have done better. I mean, as is always true, you're still building a plane while it's in the air and you learn as you go. Always true. And there's always a human price to pay for knowledge, sadly. And that's been true here too, whether it's myocarditis or pericarditis or the clotting associated with J&J and AstraZeneca vaccines, which could be fatal. There's always a human price to pay, and I hopefully will be better next time. But I think it's right from the beginning, how do we know what was going on in China? It was a whistleblower. Did you really have to depend on a whistleblower to tell you that there was a novel virus that was killing people in China? I mean, that tells you the level of international collaboration that didn't exist right from the beginning.
All right. Can we move on from COVID?
Are there other things other than COVID? I didn't know that.
Believe it or not, there are several things I'd like to ask you about as a virologist, vaccinologist, pediatrician. All right, flu 2022, what's the story? All right, shots are out there. I know people always say, when's it too early to get the vaccine? What's the right time? What do you think about the flu 2022?
Get a flu vaccine. That's easy. I can predict without fear of contradiction, there will be an influenza epidemic this year, this winter, as there is pretty much every winter. With the exception of like 2020, when we just basically eliminated respiratory viruses from this country. I mean, things like respiratory syncytial virus, flu, we didn't see any in our hospital just because we had, mass social distance, restricted travel, closed down schools, closed down businesses, which obviously we're not going to do every year. Get a flu vaccine. In terms of when to get it during the year, September, October, certainly if you're healthy and young, that will carry you through to protect you against severe disease. Again, that's the goal of the flu vaccine. Same thing, short incubation period, mucosal respiratory infection caused by an RNA virus. The goal is to protect you against severe disease. So you still may get a mild case of the flu, but you won't get flu from the flu vaccine. It's a safe and effective vaccine. There's no good. It's not like amazingly effective. It's sort of about 65-70% effective, but that's much better than than not getting the flu vaccine, which has a 0% efficacy rate.
I noticed last week, I think it was last week again, Pfizer released they had a press release that they're testing phase 3 trial of their mRNA flu vaccine. Did you see that? It's in a phase 3 trial now. What do you think about that?
Flu or RSV?
Flu.
The mRNA technology has been amazing, right? Nobody would have predicted this. I mean, our committee, FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, were told that if this vaccine is 50% effective, this was months before, that we should approve it. And then Dr. Fauci, sort of a couple months before we met, said he was hopeful it could be 70% effective. In terms of protection against severe disease, it was like 95% effective. It was amazing. So people thought, hey, this mRNA technology is remarkable. And it is amazing in the sense that Well, we give a lot of shots to children at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. What I have never seen since the smallpox vaccine was the swelling of the lymph node. I mean, that tells you how vigorous of an immune response you get. And the side effects associated with it, which are basically just the side effects of the proteins made by your immune system, fever, headache, fatigue, joint pain, muscle pain, that's all good. That means you're having a vigorous immune response. But, you know, you have a fairly high side effect rate for people. A lot of people miss work with getting this flu, this mRNA vaccine. So the thinking with the flu vaccine is, you know, there are vaccines out there that we need to make. One is a universal flu vaccine. You know, we need to because can we do something where you don't have to get a flu vaccine every year? We need an HIV vaccine. We need a better tuberculosis vaccine. We need a better malaria vaccine. Can mRNA be the answer to that problem? We'll see. So we'll see what the data show. But no, I'm skeptical. I mean, people have been working on a universal flu vaccine for 50 years. I actually trained in a flu lab back at the Wistar Institute in the early 1980s. And the head of that lab, Walter Gerhardt, said something at the time I'll never forget. He said, if you want a research career that lasts for the rest of your life, study influenza.
It'll be interesting in this flu, this mRNA flu vaccine, if you see the myocarditis. It's only 25,000 people, though, so you probably won't see it. But I won't. Oh, go ahead.
No, I don't think you will for this reason. The likely reason for myocarditis is something called molecular mimicry. The SARS-CoV-2 spike protein mimics the heavy chain of alpha myosin on cardiac cells. So if you get a vaccine against SARS-CoV-2, you make an immune response to SARS-CoV-2 spike protein while also inadvertently making an immune response to your own heart. That's also true with the virus. And there it's much worse, right? Because with when you're infected with the virus is reproducing itself again and again and again, thousands of times. So you make an even more vigorous immune response to your heart. We see that in pediatrics with the so-called multi-system inflammatory disease, which is frightening and it lands some kids in the intensive care unit. That's not the vaccine. The vaccine is a much shorter lived immune response against your heart, but it is an asymptomatic, short-lived immune response against your heart. But I don't think that'll happen with the flu because flu doesn't mimic those proteins.
Staying on the flu vaccine, I don't know if you saw this. I think it was also last week or so. I saw this blurb that the high-dose flu vaccine that they give to elderly people, it's effective against hospitalization. But then the researcher was saying there's some data to suggest it's effective against all-cause mortality. Do you have any information on it? He said the study was underpowered for that, so they're going to do a larger study. I read a follow-up in the American College of Cardiology. They didn't happen to mention the all-cause mortality thing. So I don't know. Are you hip to that? Can you talk about it?
I'm hip to it.
Great.
No, just kidding.
Well, what I mean is you're informed about it. I'm not stretching my limits here.
That's what happens when a couple older people have a conversation. You use words like hip, but that's okay.
Is that outdated?
It's got to be outdated, isn't it? Hip outdated.
Okay, I don't know.
I could be wrong.
I'm a musician. We use it all the time. Okay, anyway, all-cause mortality, underpowered study. What can you tell me?
I think it makes, here's how you can make sense of that. I mean, if you have, say, chronic heart disease or chronic lung disease or other problems and you get flu, that could be your way out. So therefore, a flu vaccine could protect from an earlier death caused by a variety of other things. So therefore, it could affect all-cause mortality. I think that's possible.
You mentioned the RSV vaccine. That is one thing I want to talk about. That's also a respiratory syncytial virus, something that attacks young people mostly and the elderly. What's the data on that?
That's exactly right. So I think we're close to an RSV vaccine. I think they finally figured out how to make an RSV vaccine, which is going to be based on the one protein of the virus, the so-called fusion protein. And like this SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is also basically that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, is a fusion protein. And we learned that you needed to lock it into its pre-fusion state. And that's what we did with the RSV vaccine. So I think within the next couple of years, you're going to see an RSV vaccine that I think will come in for two groups. One is people, the elderly, as you mentioned. And two is probably pregnant women. So that women who are pregnant, when they get the vaccine, will then passively transfer antibodies that are protective to their unborn child. Because usually when you see that virus as a killer, and it kills about 5,000 children a year, it really is the premature infant who suffers, and then children in the first 6 months of life. So it would be better actually to immunize the mother in that case, for the same reason we immunize the mother to protect the child against pertussis, whooping cough, or influenza. I think that this could become a routine maternal vaccine.
And you mentioned the number of vaccines children get, and you're at Children's Hospital Philadelphia. What the song was 11 Shots by Two. You're at Children's Hospital. That's where Stanley Plotkin, he's the R in MMR, correct? Maurice Hilleman, is that correct? He's the R, right?
He's the R in MMR.
And he, how's he doing?
He's doing well. I think he's around 90. He's sharp as a tack. It's amazing. It is amazing. I mean, I've known a few people like that. Maurice Hilleman, this is arguably the father of modern vaccines, who developed 9 of the 14 vaccines we give to infants and young children. He too, at the age of 85, which was around the time he died, was as sharp as a tack. It amazes me. I mean, I'm always word searching, wondering whether these are the first signs of dementia. I'm just 71. And it's amazing. And it's interesting. A friend of mine named Lucy Work Adams, who is a neuropathologist. When Albert Einstein died, she was given a slice of his brain to evaluate, right? So he too died, I think, I have to look, but certainly at least in his 80s, I would imagine. And what she found was that, you know, because what can you see in a brain that describes someone who was as brilliant as Einstein? And she said it was clean. It didn't have this sort of plaquing that you see as you get older. It was just cleaner. And maybe that's how people like Dr. Plotkin and Dr. Hilleman continue to be brilliant. They just have cleaner brains.
Did you ever think that you would see polio headlines again in this country? I know it's in other countries sporadically. It doesn't make its way here. It's been a few months since that came out, but you didn't ever think you'd see that. What happened?
Again, I'll start from the beginning. When Jonas Salk made his polio vaccine in 1955, he made it by taking polio virus, growing it up in cell culture, purifying it, and killing it. And that was a vaccine we used here from 1955 to the early 1960s. Then that was replaced by Albert Sabin's vaccine. He made the vaccine by taking the virus, growing it up in cell culture, like monkey kidney cells or monkey testicular cells, several, many, many times to try and weaken it. The thinking being, as you serially adapt the virus to growth in monkey kidney cells, it becomes less and less capable of growing in people. And that was the vaccine that we used from the early 1960s up until about the year 2000. The problem with that vaccine, the Faustian bargain that we made with that vaccine, is that it could actually revert to so-called neurovirulent type, which is to say, and it does with everybody. Everybody who gets that vaccine can revert to neurovirulent type. It can. But most people who get polio, even most people who got natural polio before there ever was a polio vaccine, most people who got polio didn't get paralyzed by the virus. It was really a mild summer intestinal virus. But for most people, it was asymptomatic. But it was a common virus. And so now we had a vaccine. But this vaccine, the Sabin vaccine, you could shed virus because the virus wasn't attenuated or weakened for growth in the intestine. It was weakened for growth in the nervous system. So you could shed the virus for months in your intestine, and it could revert then to these neurovirulent types. Now, and cause paralysis. It did. So even though we eliminated polio from this country in the 1970s, still every year, 8 to 10 children would get paralyzed by the polio vaccine throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. And in the 80s and 90s, those were the only causes of polio in this country, was the polio vaccine. That which is why in 2000, we replaced the oral vaccine with the inactivated vaccine. I was actually on the advisory committee for immunization practices at the time. I was the head of the polio working group, and I got to be one of those people that moved us away from the oral vaccine to the inactivated vaccine because we had to do that. I mean, Scandinavian countries only use the inactivated vaccine and eliminated polio from their country, so we really arguably never had to go to the Sabin vaccine. We could have stayed with the Salk vaccine, but we didn't, and paid a price at some level. So now what you see, these strains circulate, these neurovirulent strains, these strains that were derived from the polio vaccine, so-called vaccine-associated paralytic strains, are always circulating. And if vaccine rates drop far enough, you see it happen. And that's what happened in New York. There was a case of polio in an under-vaccinated community, an Orthodox community in Rockland County, it was under-vaccinated. And so when you see him get a case of polio, you can assume thousands of people were infected with that virus. And we looked at wastewater, and you see evidence of that type, that so-called type 2 revertant virus in the wastewater. I bet it's in many places in this country. I really do think if we looked in Las Vegas or San Francisco or Chicago or Philadelphia, that you would see these strains in wastewater, which tells you one thing: make sure you're vaccinated. And if you were vaccinated as a child, you're protected. Even now, if you were vaccinated 60 years ago as a child, you're protected. But if you're not vaccinated, you're at risk.
So this headline is the child of a low vaccination rate in one community.
There's a 27-year-old, I think. So not a child, but yes, some an adult.
I meant the child of the headline. The headline was born. The headline was born from low vaccination rates.
You're right.
All right, I want to wrap up. I'm sorry we ran a bit long, but I have one question. What are you working on? And then if you have any tips for young writers. I've been fortunate to work with a good editor over a couple of years, a couple of different ones, and it's a humbling and learning experience, you know, to see something changed in every paragraph or maybe every sentence. But it's a super learning thing. So can you talk about, you know, you've written so much. Talk about writing, if you don't mind, and if you have anything you'd like to say.
So I'm actually working on a book with National Geographic Press that's called Tell Me When It's Over, which is about sort of where we're heading with this virus, kind of where we were, where we are, and where we're heading. But it's hard. And talk about moving targets. I mean, it's, you know, trying to write a book when, you know, say the bivalent vaccine just came out. You know, it's a little hard to comment on that since there's so much we don't know yet. But it's the writing process. I love the process of writing. I do really enjoy it. But you said the right word, humbling. It's humbling. I mean, you try and try and try as be as clear as you can, as compelling as you can, as passionate and compassionate as you can. And you're never there. But you just keep trying.
Dr. Offit, I greatly appreciate your time. Oh, by the way, over the 3 years of all interviews, you have any anecdote or something that you'd like to talk about? I mean, you've been on the air so much. How's it been going?
Problem on the air a lot is that you're going to be wrong, you know, and then people can show up, see. Actually, the one thing I would say right now is I have questioned the value of a booster dose in all. I've done that publicly, and I've questioned the value of the bivalent vaccine, which has sadly caused me to be embraced by at least some people in the anti-vaccine movement. This one person on his Substack put up something that said, you know, here, he's anti-vaccine. And it's not to question a vaccine is not to be anti-vaccine. If the data support your questioning, fair. I mean, I voted against the smallpox vaccine back in like early 2000s, right before we invaded Iraq. There was an interest in vaccinating all first-line responders. I didn't think we needed to do that. That didn't make me anti-vaccine. It just meant that I had reasons for why I voted no there. For the same reasons I had for voting no here. I mean, you're anti-vaccine if you basically put out the kind of false safety concerns that causes you or others not to get vaccinated. That's an anti-vaccine person. I mean, for example, when we moved to the inactivated polio vaccine in this country in 2000, I brought a person onto that committee, the polio committee at the CDC, whose name was John Salomon. I mean, his son had been paralyzed by the oral polio vaccine, and he was upset. He felt that the vaccine should have a black box warning on it. I didn't know about this, he said. I didn't know this was possible. I didn't know other countries were using an inactivated vaccine that was safer. I didn't know. He was a vaccine safety activist because he had a real issue with vaccine safety. The so-called vaccine safety activists today aren't talking about things that have anything to do with vaccine safety. So they're not vaccine safety activists. They're just anti-vaccine activists or anti-science activists.
Dr. Offit, thank you so much for being here. I greatly appreciate your time over these last 3 years. You've been on several times to help clear things up and make sense of it for me and everybody listening. So thanks so much. This is 502 Conversations. Once again, thank you.